Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The reason I got into politics was because I had watched so many of my friends who I had grown up with who had farms lose their farms. And it was frustrating to see some of the programs in place that were not conducive with a free market, allowing people to be successful, but it was always so dependent on the government. And allowing the government to play a role that is assistive, supportive, making sure that we have access to markets, but in no way, shape, or form disadvantaging one against the other.
California Representative David Valadao.
It's something that I take very seriously. And stuff that we put in the farm bills over the years has been helpful. But I think GT is doing his due diligence. I think he's doing a great job in making sure that he's asking all the right questions so that when we have the opportunity to actually move forward with that final package, it'll be something that'll be good for agriculture across the board.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
What really was our first official listening session after the committee organized. We got our feet wet up in Pennsylvania in January. Just thrilled to be here in California at the World Agriculture Expo, where we, I think, had a really, really successful listening session.
Chairman of the House Ag Committee, G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania, says there was a common theme.
Well, there was a lot. The importance of trade obviously stood out. You know, the value of the market access program, the foreign market development program, you know, makes a lot of sense when you look at these specialty crops here in California, how much of that high percentage that is exported around the world, and that's great for our economy here, and quite frankly, for the a healthy U.S. agriculture. But, you know, other water, obviously, California. What, you know, the unfortunate state of California has just not really kept up, been forward thinking on water retention. There's plenty of water, right, whether it's at flood time or usually snow melt. But you got to retain it, right? And you got to retain it where you need it. And that would be in an area to be able to feed a nation, to feed the, feed California. So that's a recurring issue, no doubt about it.
And agrees agriculture does have concerns about trade and infrastructure.
It won't be infrastructure in terms of canals, ports, which needs to be addressed. We need to modernize in a serious way. I mean, we have ports of entry and ports of export that cannot accommodate these larger shipping vessels that we now have. And so, for whatever reason, the United States has not kept up in those investments, and we need to do that. We need to be able to move our agriculture commodities efficiently. We need to make this a place where these companies that operate these vessels want to come to, right? Also, we need to look at some policies. Like, there's an awful lot of shipping containers that are going back empty, specifically to China, and that's wrong. I mean, we're buying products, and they need to be fulfilling their trade promises and buying our commodities.
Now, representing the 19th Congressional District of California, member of the House Ag Committee, Jimmy Panetta.
Always good to be out in the Central Valley. Coming from the Central Coast in the 19th Congressional District, it's nice to come out here. And obviously, we may have some different agriculture, but like I said, we find our similarities when it comes to the issues. And hopefully that's what you saw today, us basically, you know, being up there, Democrats and Republicans, actually listening to the issues that affect all our districts and affect all of agriculture. So look forward to be able to take that information back to Washington, D.C., and work on the Farm Bill coming up here, and making sure that we can come together for people that mean so much, not just to our districts, but for our nation's agriculture.
And though Panetta never moved, his district did.
Look, in the 20th Congressional District, I had the salad bowl, but this Independent Redistricting Commission kind of carved that out. But what I lose in lettuce, I gain in wine. So not a bad trade-off. But obviously, it's about specialty crops. It's about the research that's necessary to fight the disease, the pests, and also continue to work on basically mechanization in regards to what type of replacements can we have. Not replacing labor, replacing the lack of labor, as we know, and hopefully finding a way to have a reasonable, sensible immigration reform like the Farm Workforce Modernization Act that protects our ag workers, people who are willing to come here, do the work that no American's willing to do, and continue to contribute not just to our economy, not just to our communities, but to our culture and what we stand for as a country, especially when it comes to our agriculture. So obviously, good to be here. A lot of information I think we gleaned today. But as I say, as a former prosecutor, this is evidence upon which we can make our argument for a strong agricultural nation.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
As a daughter of a fourth generation farmer, and now being the fifth generation on this same land, my husband and I have been farming together for the last 40 years. The last 27 years, crop insurance has been a cornerstone of our operation.
Marcia Bunger is the administrator of USDA's Risk Management Agency, testifying recently before the Senate Ag Committee.
Today, 27 years later, his corn and bean policy is the best in the world. And so it's my personal commitment that we also elevate specialty crop growers. We also elevate our urban ag producers, along with organic farmers, that they too have the same type of policy that my husband and I have had for the last 27 years. What we've done at RMA is to, in the last year, host numerous stakeholder meetings. We've hosted what we call the RMA Roadshow, where we've gone out both in virtual presence and in in-person presence and hosted a number of training educational opportunities for the whole farm program and also for microfarm. In the last year, we've taken the steps to reduce red tape with the paperwork with whole farm and microfarm. We've doubled the amount of revenue limits on whole farm. We've tripled that for microfarm so that now even more small beginning farmers have the opportunity to use that microfarm policy. In addition, we've partnered with the climate partners, and we've introduced what we refer to as TOGA. You know, we just love acronyms at USDA, the Transition Organic Growers Assistance Program, where we're providing incentives to organic growers as they transition to organics, but also to those that are currently in organics growing feed grains. You know, it's a passion of mine that all of these growers, whether they are beginning farmers, whether they are veterans, that they too have the same kind of policy that my husband and I have used for the last several years.
She also talks about how they stand up new tools.
Currently, how RMA stands up all of its different crop policies, I call it a three-pronged approach. We look to the Hill, we look to you to have us stand up those policies that you write. We also look to the 508H process, where private submitters submit, and they also involve then recommendations, support from growers, much like the corn growers did with PACE. And then the third is within the department itself, within what guidelines that RMA has to stand up programs. All of those come with reviewers and actuarial soundness that needs to be maintained. So it's a balance. With the 508H process, they are supported by reviewers and also AIPs that recommend how marketable the products are. So we will continue to work through those and take a look at those. The policies that are available have increased exponentially. You know, in 2000, I believe RMA had 300 policies, and now today we are at 600 policies. The billions of dollars of liability that are covered under those policies have grown also dramatically.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
This shows you a little bit of the data going back over the last 40 years looking at cow-calf profitability.
Randy Block is president and CEO of Cattle Facts and identifies the Achilles heel of the industry.
And I would say if we really have an Achilles heel in this industry, we don't have enough profitability back at our cow-calf operators. Just not enough profitability. You start going through these numbers, these are just cow-calf annual cost. This doesn't take into account return to management, depreciation when you look at these numbers. Again, I think when we look at the long-term benefit of this industry, if we're going to be a sustainable growing industry for decades to come, this has got to improve. I mean, we need to see calf prices significantly higher than they are now, but we need to be able to sustain them at these higher price levels. If those of you in these further channels up the line are going to have the animals available for your growing operations, your grazing operations, and also for our finishing operations and on through our packing plants. Remember, the last couple of cycles, we basically have topped our cow numbers at 31.5 to 32 million beef cows. And, of course, drought was the main factor that brought us through the declines that we've come through here. But, again, profitability is a big part of it. And I think you can see that and appreciate it when you look at the long-term data here. Again, we just really have to be more profitable at this segment of the industry if the rest of the industry is going to be able to prosper.
He also has a warning for the industry.
This is the spread between calf prices and fed cattle prices and feeder cattle prices and fed cattle prices. They've been pretty flat, haven't they? Once we came through 2013, 14, 15, when we had the big spike, they pretty well flatlined. What are those going to look like as we go down the road? I mean, it's going to get pretty wild. It's going to get pretty wild. We're going to see unprecedented price spreads in here on all these different classes of cattle. I don't think there's any doubt about it. This will give you a little bit of perspective what I'm talking about. If you'll focus your eyes on the bars that say 160, as an industry, we basically have been buying cattle to break even right around 160 here over the last several months. And with cost of gains at about $1.30 to $1.35, where we've had a lot of cost of gains here recently, that would suggest the break-even purchase price on an 800-pound steer is about $1.80. If cost of gains moved back to $1.10, look how we moved that needle. They're at $1.95. Now fast forward with me. Think about Kevin's outlook over the course of the next few years. Let's assume we start buying break-evens up in here closer to $1.80. And cost of gains are still at $1.30. We've got 2.15 feeders instead of $1.80 like we've got today. We've got cost of gains that have moved back in here, as Mike suggested, as we get into the fall of the year and we start to see some moderation in grain prices. Again, you can get cost of gains. You can start to see some tremendous price spreads in here on these feeder cattle. So this is the time in here that I would really encourage those of you is that you're really going to need to pay attention. When these markets move, they're going to have significant moves. They're going to create opportunities for you to lock in some solid profits on these different classes of cattle that you're working through. But you're really going to need to be attentive because these things are not going to be, they're not going to be tame.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
From World Ag Expo 2023, I'm Tony St. James, and we ran into Paul Mikesell. Paul is the founder and CEO of Carbon Robotics and the Laser Weeder. Is that right?
Laser Weeder, yep, correct. Yeah, and I am Paul Mikesell. Hello.
Okay, so Paul, tell us a little, first off, about the company.
Yeah.
And how you came up with the company.
Been working on the laser weeder for 4 years. We realized that AI and robotics needed to get into agriculture. So we dove in head first and just kept going and working hard until we figured out what would work. What works for weed control? AI, computer visions, and really high-powered lasers. So our machines, we find those weeds in the fields live. Our AI system is evaluating what it's seen in the camera. It says weed, weed, weed. It puts the lasers on them, kills all the weeds, keeps your field clean. No herbicides, no people out there pulling weeds. It's a win-win.
Now, so when we talk about weeds, what's the technology that goes behind, say, whether it's a corn or cotton?
Yeah.
First off, I guess what commodities are you in?
Sure, yeah.
How does it know it's a weed?
Yeah, okay, great. So we focus a lot on specialty and vegetable crops. So we do a lot of onions, broccolis, cauliflowers, a lot of lettuces, spinach, spring mix, that kind of thing, a lot of carrots. We've done some organic corn, some organic soy, that kind of stuff. Typically, you're kind of higher value crops where they're going to, and we've got some videos here of these are spinaches, really high density spinaches. So how does it know what's a weed, what's a crop? So this is a subsection of AI called deep learning. These are deep learning neural nets. It's the same kind of technology that like ChatGPT, you probably heard about that. So that's a neural net. So we use a computer vision version of that same kind of technology. We take a bunch of images. We tell the computer, this is a weed, this is a crop, this is the weed, this is the crop. Computer learns that. And then we take that piece of the computer that has learned that, put it in the robot, connect it up to the lasers. Here we go.
Wow. Yep. Okay, so if we were using herbicides, we'd have to be refilling the tank. Do you have to refill the laser?
No, those lasers are good. They're self-contained. They run. We just put some voltage into it. Out comes a mix of plasma, and that creates heat energy. And our machine knows how to put that heat energy right on the right spot in the plant to burn it and make it die. No refill on the lasers. They're good, sealed, self-contained unit.
Okay, so you were here last year.
Yeah.
What's different?
Yeah, this is the same laser weeder we brought out last year. So what's different, we've added a lot of software functionality. So there's a lot of new crop models, so we can do over 40 crops now. And the big thing is that we're announcing this year, just announced actually, we do not only laser weeding, but we'll also do laser thinning. So if you want to go out and you want to thin your crops to stand, we could do that. So we can clean out your weeds and thin your crops at the same time. A laser weeder can do it all, and that's doable just with the software upgrade. So we did the hardware once, and we did it right, and then new software on top of that, on top of the existing hardware platform.
So you're already out in the field, multiple states. What states?
We got machines right now in California, Arizona, New Mexico, Washington. And then this year, we're deploying to about 6 or 7 new states in the United States. Got some machines going to Canada. We're going to ship about 3 to 4 times as many machines this year as we did last year. So we're really ramping up volume to keep up with demand for the laser weeder.
Paul, great to see you.
Great.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Paul Mikesell is the founder and CEO of Carbon Robotics and the Laser Weeder. From World Ag Expo 2023, I'm Tony St. James.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Secretary Vilsack recently announced a substantial investment to support the adoption of climate smart practices by farmers, ranchers, and forest owners through the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities program.
Robert Bonney is Under Secretary for Farm Production and Conservation at USDA, testifying recently before the Senate Ag Committee on the next Farm Bill.
The effort will finance the production of climate smart commodities through partner-led pilot and demonstration projects that help expand and create markets for these commodities. In all these efforts, USDA remains committed to a voluntary, incentive-based, and collaborative approach to conservation and climate change. Ultimately, none of our work is possible without a strong and well-trained workforce. FSA Field Operations has prioritized hiring staff in county offices while taking steps to address recruitment and retention. More than 22,000 FPAC employees continue to deliver the 2018 Farm Bill programs to keep our agricultural producers in business and help them build stronger operations each year. I look forward to continued collaboration with the committee as we seek to provide more efficient, effective, and inclusive support to the farmers, ranchers, and producers we serve.
He also heard the same message from both sides of the aisle, finding ways to make it easier for producers.
I think the point that both you and the chair have made on the importance of reducing paperwork, rolling things out more quickly is really, really important. In the case of emergency relief, the emergency relief program, we tried to use existing data, pre-filled forms, and other things that would both reduce the workload, frankly, on our field offices, but reduce the workload on producers. And so we think there's a lot to learn there to move resources more quickly, and we think that will allow us as we move forward. I mentioned it in my opening comments about the rice assistance, that we think we can take some lessons there to move more quickly. Again, we think crop insurance is critically important. We think NAP, there are significant opportunities there, areas for us to improve NAP to make it easier for producers to get in. But as you point out, there is growing interest and has been resources for these ad hoc programs. And I think our job, on the implementation side is to get those out as efficiently and quickly as we can to help our producers. And to look for ways that we can enhance our tools, whether it's crop insurance, some of the programs Administrator Ducheneau works on, to expand them in ways that are most responsive to producers' needs.
And it's not just about making it easier for producers to work with the government. It's giving them flexible tools.
I think your point about one size fits all is really important. Whether it's conservation or climate smart ag, it's going to look different to different producers. Our job is to provide a toolbox. And I think with respect to crop insurance, everything we have to do has to be actuarially sound, right? We've got to maintain the integrity of crop insurance. That's critically important. As you know, we've provided some incentives for cover crops, using a rebate there that doesn't affect the actuarial soundness of the program, but provides an option for producers. I think as we think about climate, productivity in and of itself is important. Got to keep producers producing. They've got to be economically viable. So anything we do, whether it's in crop insurance and elsewhere, has to recognize that that's critical. And again, I think your point about the need for flexible tools is critical.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Look at the growth in beef demand that we've experienced in here and where all of that growth has come from over the course of the last 15 years. It's all on the choice and higher grades, isn't it? All of the demand growth.
Randy Block, President, CEO, Cattle Facts.
Look at the red line on this chart. That's select. If you look at the demand curve in here on select, it's the same spot it was in 1998 when we were at our low watermark in demand. We've taken our high-quality fed beef production from 55% choice and prime to 83% choice and prime. We have record spreads. That tells you the consumers love what we're putting in front of. And we have to continue to stay focused on that. When we look at these protein considerations, this comes out of the consumer beef tracker data. I think this is great data. And again, this goes back to your checkoff dollars of what we're doing out here. What's the number one driver of purchase decisions? It's great tasting. What's the number two? It's safe. What's number three? It's a great value proposition. And you can see as we move on through here, these are the things that I would say to you. This is why we've been winning the battle of wallet, of consumer spending here over time, is because we have a great tasting product and it's safe. People can trust it, not only here, but around the globe. Now, we're going to see prices in here as we move forward, move significantly higher. They're going to move significantly higher. I mean, you're not going to see these kind of supply shocks and not see the needle move and move pretty quickly. So you do need to be prepared for that. We will see record high prices at all classes of cattle here over the course of the next several years. And again, it will tend to move pretty quick. We still will actually be in the new highs this year. We'll be making new highs before the year is over when we think about fed cattle prices, et cetera. Feeders and calves, maybe not, but fed cattle prices are certainly going to be there. Once we see a little bit moderation in the feed costs, we'll likely start to see that transfer over to calf and feeder cattle values as well. It really does come back to the profitability, though, doesn't it? I mentioned the cow-calf profitability. It's not been great enough. At the overall industry level, when we look at overall profitability, when we look at accumulated profitability, it's obviously been better, but it still needs to get better. It needs to get better if we're going to grow the profitability at that cow-calf level to where it's sustainable. That's something that we need to expect. So we'll see more dollars that'll be flowing back into that here over the course of the next few years.
What does Cattle Facts expect moving ahead?
Now, consumers are going to be tested a little bit in here, but again, we're going to see nearly a 5% drop in per capita beef supplies in here. So you're going to start to see some rationing take place in that segment of the industry as we go forward. Total meat production, because of these higher cost environments we're in, obviously they're going to be flatter in here. We won't see significant increases, but we should see an improvement in profitability at a number of these segments of the industry, not only this year, but as we move on into 2024 and 2025 as well. The biggest challenge, I think, for producers in all segments of the industry, with the exception of the cow-calf producers, is just where am I going to find enough supply to keep my operations full? That will be the biggest challenge, and I'd say the thing that you'll have to navigate the hardest on as we work through this year.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
USDA's soybean world production forecast for February showed a similar pattern as corn, a total downward adjustment in production due to a month-over-month reduction in what is expected to come from Argentina.
Given the drought conditions, we reduced our production forecast for Argentina 4.5 million tons. So currently it is forecast at 41 million tons. That would be down 2.9 million from last year.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jackanowski said the lower production led to tighter supplies on the global balance sheet.
Global soybean trade, we're looking at lower exports out of Argentina, but almost nearly offset by higher exports from Paraguay and Brazil.
Minor adjustments to the U.S. balance sheet contributed to a season-ending average price adjustment up of one dime to $14.30 a bushel. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.